Yeah, I'll call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. And let the record reflect that the time is currently 8:04 a.m. on Monday, April 10th, 2017. And present today, we have Representative Ortiz, Kawasaki, Wilson, Representative Tilton, Wren, and Thompson, and Co-Chair Seaton, and myself, Co-Chair Foster. And we also have with us Vice Chair Guerra. And before we start, just a reminder, folks could mute their cell phones. And at this meeting, we'll be addressing a CS for HB 26, which is the Appropriation Limit and Permanent Fund Dividend Bill by the Governor. And we have a CS for SB 26 before us. Co-Chair Seaton, can I have a motion to bring the CS for SB 26 Finance, version 30-GS1690/U, before the committee as a working draft?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd move to bring House CS for committee substitute for Senate Bill 26, 30-GS1690/U, adopt that as the committee's working document.
Objection. And we have a objection. And at this time, if we could have Representative Seaton's aide, Tanika Hansen, to, if we could have her come to the table and walk the committee through the CS. And if you could put yourself on the record and go ahead and proceed.
For the record, Tanika Hansen, staff to Representative Seaton. So the CS for SB 26 has it's a very similar mechanism to what we've seen in other bills before us, especially relating to how the percent of market value draw from the earnings reserve is functioning, and also the amount that's distributed to the general fund and to the dividends. So if we look at the comparison between the two documents, in the CS, section 1 for SB 26, which was intent language, has been deleted. Section 2 for the Senate version of SB 26, which was a conforming change for the deletion of 3705-540B, the appropriation limit in the statutory budget reserve fund, that section has been deleted because the finance CS no longer deletes or no longer repeals 3705-540B. And section 3 from the Senate version of SB 26, creating a new appropriation limit, that section has also been deleted. Section 1 of the House Finance CS is relating to the Marine Highway Fund, and it's conforming language to the change, actually the change made in Section 3, relating to the bonus royalties. Section 2 of the House Finance CS relates to AS 3707-020, responsibility of the governor, and it adds to that that the governor shall make a report on how the budget complies with the appropriation limit that exists in the Constitution, Article 9, Section 16. Section 3, relating to AS 3713010A, the Alaska Permanent Fund, is the same as in the Senate version of 26. Section 4, relating to income of the Permanent Fund, is the same as Section 6 of the Senate version. Section 5, also relating to income of the Permanent Fund, AS 3713140B, is the same. And AS 3713140C is a new subsection in both bills relating to a revenue draw limit when certain oil revenues are reached. It's very similar, but instead of being dollar for dollar, it is now 80 cents on the dollar, and the oil revenues, which will trigger that limit, has been moved to $1.4 billion. Section 6 of the CS relates to AS 3713-140B income. And this is, again, relating to the POMV draw, lowering it from 5.25 to 5. This is the same as was Section 8 of the Senate version, except that Section 6 of the House Finance version has an effective date of July 1st, 2019. The effective date in the Senate CS was July 1st, 2020. Section 7 of the bill amends AS 3713-140B, the disposition of income from the fund, to say that 0.25% of market value is directed annually to the principal of the fund, and then separately 33% of the percent of market value calculated under AS 3713-140B is directed from the earnings reserve to the dividend, and 67% is directed to the general fund for state use. The Senate version of the bill had repealed AS 3713-145B and created a new subsection for disposition of income. Section 8 of the House Finance CS is conforming language to the change in the previous section. Section 9, AS 3713-145E, is relating to transfers of money between the earnings reserve and the principal when the value of the earnings reserve is four times the draw amount created in AS 3713-145B. Is very similar to Section 10 from the Senate version, but has the additional language stating that the transfer between the funds will not exceed the amount necessary to make up for any past inflation proofing, which was not done. And additionally, in AS 3713-145E, the House CS has a new subsection F, which directs additional revenue or additional appropriation if necessary to ensure that the dividends for fiscal years 18 and 19 will be at least $1,250. Section 10, AS 3713-145E and F, this is a, Section 10 has a effective date of June 30th, 2020. It's relating to the end of the minimum dividend of $12.50. AS 3713-146, which was Section 11 in the Senate version, has been deleted. This was where the funds were being split between the general fund and the dividend fund, which the House Finance version achieves in 3713-145. Section 11 of the House Finance version, AS 3713-150, relating to the budget for the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation, includes that the unexpended balance of the Permanent Fund Corporation's budget is a part of the calculation of the market value of the total fund. Section 12 of both bills remain the same. Section 13 of the Senate version was relating to AS 4323025A and stated that the amount of the dividend would be based on the appropriation under AS 3713-146. This has been deleted because we're using 45B instead of 146 for the calculation. AS 4323-025C, in the Senate version, Section 14 had stated that the dividend for the fiscal years 18, 19, and 20 would be $1,000. In the House version, Section 13, new subsection C is amended to state that notwithstanding the existing calculation for the size of the dividend for the fiscal years 18 and 19 shall be at least $12.50. AS 4323-045A, relating to the dividend fund, was Section 15 of the Senate bill. This has been deleted. In the Senate version of SB 26, the amount for the dividend was going into the general fund and then was separately appropriated into the dividend fund, and Section 15 was clarifying some of this flow of money. In the House Finance version, the dividend is being transferred directly from the earnings reserve to the dividend fund. Language is slightly different. This clarifying language was not seen as needed. Duties of the department, which is AS 4323055. This is Section 14 of the House CS and is the same as was in Section 16 of the previous version. In Section 15 of the House CS is repealing AS 3713145C, which is the existing inflation proofing calculation, and that's repealed on July 1st, 2017, the same as it was in the previous version of this bill. Section 16 repeals AS 3713145F and AS 4323025C, both on June 30th, 2020, which is relating to the minimum dividend of $12.50 and any appropriation necessary to reach that dividend. The Senate version of the bill had repealed the existing statutory budget reserve appropriation limit in AS 3705, 540B, and C on July 1st, 2017. Those repeals have been deleted. Section 17 of the House CS is uncodified law for fiscal year 17, stating that for fiscal year 17, the legislature may appropriate from the earnings reserve of the fund 5.25% of the market value, less the dividend already paid out for the fiscal year. Section 18 is retroactivity language, stating that the previous section for fiscal year 17 is retroactively effective to June 29, 2017. Section 19 is conditional language, stating that this act only takes effect if the legislature also passes and signs into law a broad-based revenue measure and House Bill 111. And Sections 20, 21, 22, and 23 are effective dates for various sections of the bill.
And with that, do we have any questions for Ms. Hansen? Representative Wilson and then Gary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So is it fair to say that this is basically HB 115 minus the income tax placed into SB 26?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, yes, it's very similar to the components that were seen before the committee in 115.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
So do we have a legal on the conditional language that we can bind one piece of legislation based on what could pass along with that?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, there was no legal opinion attached with this bill. Our legal team has used conditional language with previous legislation.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up.
So is conditional language pretty much intent language, or is there a difference between the two?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, with conditional language, the bill itself, the way the conditional language is written, the bill itself is not considered law, is not enacted unless those conditions are met.
Follow up. So I still don't understand what and I'm just trying, it's a definition issue. I'm just trying to figure out, you know, would intent language have done the same? Is there a difference between intent language and conditional language? And then when was the last time conditional language was utilized in this fashion with maybe another bill?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, intent language would not have had the same effect. Intent language is uncodified law and does not have any actual effect on the rest of the law. Conditional language says that the bill can only go into effect, can only become law if those conditions are met. I would have to ask what the last time we used it, but there's a range of conditional language, and we actually see it fairly commonly in appropriations bills or also bills relating to, say, last year when we passed SB 74 relating to Medicaid reform. There are several conditional language sections because certain things could not take, certain things could not go into effect without approval by the federal government. So, but we've also seen state legislation being conditional on other state bills passing, and I'd have to ask when the last time that was.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I also want to note that we were joined earlier by Representative Pruitt and Guttenberg. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tanika, you can, if you feel like you want somebody else to answer this, but actually you know this bill pretty well, so you just decide whether or not these are questions for you. I just want to make sure the dividend portions remain the same, and I know some of them did just from hearing from you. So the Senate bill had started out as a $1,000 dividend. This bill starts out as the greater of either $1,250, or if our formula produces a bigger dividend, it's the greater of one of those two, at least $1,250, right?
Representative Gary, yes, that's correct.
And then the formula that the Senate had, according to the legislative finance charts, it started out with their formula started out at $1,000 and then fell below $1,000 in 2021 by a little bit. The charts that we've seen in the past, and I just want to make sure the formula we have in here are the same, is the same. The charts we've seen in the past, the projections are that it would likely start out under the formula we had in 111, so I just want to make sure that same formula is in here. It would likely start out a little bit above 1250 and then rise from there. That's the 67% and 33% formula. Is that all the same in this bill?
Representative Guerra, through the chair, the formulas are the same as were in 115, which is 33% to the dividend, 67% to the general fund. The $1,250 minimum dividend, the guaranteed dividend, ends in FY19. That's also the same year that the percent of market value calculation is transitioning from a 5.25 down to 5. I believe the projections are for it to be right around 1250, perhaps a little below, a little above, but growing at a modest rate after that.
Through the chair.
Follow.
We just don't have those charts in front of us, but I'm sure we can get it from legislative finance. My recollection is that the dividend under our formula projected to start a little bit higher than 1250 and projected to grow after that, but we can get that from legislative finance.
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Going to be a lot of questions on a lot of these items. I just wanted to touch on one at the start. On page 2, the second bullet, it was mentioned a little while ago that this is very similar to the POMB that was in Senate or in House Bill 115. But it isn't, because that line, the $1.2 billion draw limit, was what we put in 115 by a vote of this body of 9-1, and yet we're changing it now to $1.4 billion and 80 cents on the dollar. So definitely different in some areas than what we had. This committee voted 9-1 with reason as to why we would put the $1.2 billion draw limit and a dollar for dollar after. It would grow the fund. It would make more money available for dividends in the future. It would make more money available for the government to use. And this is just one of the changes that I thought glared out at me very strongly. Why did we change it to the 1.4 and 80 cents on the dollar instead of the 1.2 and a dollar for dollar the way this committee had agreed to?
Representative Thompson, through the chair. Yes, that is one of the places where it's different. The percent of market value draw, the percentage that goes to the dividend, percent that goes to the general fund, the effective dates, those are all the same. There were some members that expressed interest in seeing some of that. Should we have additional revenue years to see some of that available for, say, deferred maintenance, certain one-time projects. So in that sense, it's felt that 80 cents on the dollar may allow for those one-time projects to have a little bit of that extra money to use in that year. We do have a large backlog of deferred maintenance currently.
Follow up. looking at this whole thing, I mean, including House Bill 111 with the oil tax credits, I got a feeling that with HB 111 in effect, we might never reach this revenue threshold to begin with. So go ahead.
Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, I will stay away from the item that my colleague just hit on, but I will go back to the conditional language. Mr. Chair, if it's okay, I'm going to read the conditional language, not the whole thing, but piece of it. This act takes effect only if the 30th Alaska State Legislature passes and enacts into law in 2017. I'm going to jump to number two. The version of House Bill 111 that passes out of the House of Representatives. If that doesn't sound illegal or quid pro quo, I don't know what does. That right there scares the living daylights out of me. That you would try to say that we are going to, that the other body has absolutely no ability to determine whether or not they feel that that particular piece of legislation should be amended in a different manner. You need to question that. This right here is outrageous. I mean, the good thing is if you really wanted to throw this whole bill out in a lawsuit, you've just made your out there. That right there is dangerous. I would never put that in there. I would think twice about trying to sit here and hold the other body hostage. And it's not like you did it behind the scenes. You put it right there out in the bill. dangerous. I'm just totally amazed that I'm actually reading this in here.
Any further questions of the committee? Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I understand tempers rise. In my personal view, I think we can be a lot more polite to each other in the words that we use. But I'll address the conditional effect and why I like it. There have been attempts by many legislators in this legislature to say only reduce the dividend and use permanent fund earnings. Don't do anything to raise other revenue. Let the oil industry keep the law in place that benefits their bottom line the most. And don't ask those with the greatest privilege to chip in. The permanent fund only hits the poorest people in Alaska the hardest. If you have $10,000 of income and you lose some of your permanent fund dividend and you don't really live in a cash economy, you are hit hard by just a permanent fund plan. So there's an attempt in here to raise the dividend, but there's also an attempt to say a fiscal plan should be fair for everybody. If somebody who struggles to make ends meet is going to chip in, and I'm glad the dividend in here is larger, but those with the greatest privilege should also chip in a fair way. And that's what the conditional language says, that if this bill passes, the people who vote for it support a balanced fiscal plan that says those with privilege, those with wealth, those who live much more comfortably should chip in. And it may be characterized however anybody wants to characterize it, but to me it says balance. And I'm not going to cast aspersions against anybody who disagrees with me, and I would hope that those who are on the other side would not cast aspersions, because I think that we could use a lot better decorum in here. But I agree with it because it says balance and a fair contribution from those who have much, not just from those who don't.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to respectfully disagree because that's not what it says. Number two, under the conditional effects on 19 and 20, takes away the other body's mandate to represent their constituents and vet a bill. Because basically if they vet the bill and they find any differences to it, by passing this bill, we're going to say it doesn't matter what they found, even if it's something better, even if it's something more fair, something that balances it even in a different way, because we're going to say that only one way can it happen. conditional effect and saying you want certain things like you do in number one where it has to be a broad-based tax directed to education, which that just sends a message as if we're going to pay on education, pay more into education, which we're not, because it goes into the education fund, which can be sent anywhere in the budget. It's estimated to be generate annually at least $650 million once fully implemented. That could be a sales tax, it could be an income tax, it could be any kind of tax, but at least number one allows the other body to vet out different bills to come up with something. But number two doesn't do that. And I think that's where the constitutionality goes with it, is that can one body mandate to another body that they don't have the right to vet a bill and make changes to it? Because if they do, then it then takes this one out of it. And, you know, maybe there are no other ideas, but I doubt that seriously. There's a lot of smart people on both sides here, and that's where I have an issue with it, is that specific onto, not that we're trying to make sure that everything is fair and everybody's hit in the same fashion, because the other part that this bill doesn't talk about is reducing the budget whatsoever. It's continuing to let it grow up to $1 billion in 9 years by using the inflation rate that we saw in the charts that we had. And I'm assuming that if we saw the charts for this particular bill, it would pretty much be what we've already seen with House Bill 115. There really wouldn't be any difference on the growth in that portion of it. But I am very concerned when we're being that specific as we are on page 8 and saying that that the other body does not have the right to vet a bill, just like we've spent time vetting this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got a motion on the floor as to whether or not we adopt the CS as a working draft. Is the objection maintained?
This is Mr. Chairman.
The objection is maintained. If the Secretary could please call the roll.
Representative Kawasaki?
Yes.
Representative Ortiz?
Yes.
Representative Pruitt?
No.
Representative Thompson?
No.
Representative Tilton?
No.
Representative Wilson?
No.
Representative Garrett?
Yes.
Representative Grimm?
Yes.
Representative Guttenberg?
Yes.
Representative Seaton?
Yes.
Representative Foster?
Yes.
7 yea, 4 nay.
And on a vote of 7 yeas and 4 nays, the committee substitute for SB 26 version U is now before the committee. And at this time, if we could get Commissioner Hoffbeck to the table, and if you could put yourself on the record and let the committee know what the administration's position is on the CS for SB 26.
Chair Foster, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. The administration has typically reserved its strongest the statements on bills until after they pass out of a body, recognizing the fact that there's still a substantial amount of work to be done before this actually is passed on the floor. And so we are pleased that we've got a permanent fund bill that is moving through the House, and look forward to seeing what the final version looks like.
Does the committee have any questions for Commissioner Hoffbeck, Representative Thompson, and then Guerra?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Commissioner Hoffbeck, just at first blush, this looks like it kind of weakens the permanent fund. You're a trustee on the permanent fund board, and speaking as a trustee on the permanent fund board, but not as commissioner or for the administration, how do you compare this to other versions that we've had?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson, all of the bills that have been moved this year have all been a PONV-based version. They've had similar draw components. This one actually reduces the draw from 5.25 to 5 1 year earlier than the Senate bill. It also has the secondary provision in there for a 0.25% inflation proofing on an annual basis and tracking of the to make sure that that the draws are, or the inflation proofing does keep up with inflation over time. So I don't see that this appreciably makes that much difference as far as the permanent funds side of the equation.
Follow up. specifically the draw limit, the administration was in favor of a $1.2 billion with a dollar for dollar. This moves it to $1.4 billion with an 80 cents to the dollar. This looks to me like it's going to have a real effect on the fund. Your opinion?
Through the chair, Representative Thompson. It does increase the chance of failure, but not that much. It's still under 2% chance of failure, even with this draw limit. So it's not a significant chance of failure. I think the bigger issue that raising the threshold and doing the 80 cents on a dollar is it's not nearly as effective in taking volatility out of the revenue forecasts, that you will still see more volatility in budgeting. So I think that's the bigger impact it has, rather than substantially making more risk to the fund.
Representative Gere.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a lot of questions about the draw limit. Just to be fair, in this committee, at one point there was the draw limit as the administration wanted. At one point there was no draw limit. At one point the draw limit went back, and now the draw limit is 80%. There are different views on this committee. I think probably there are different views throughout the legislature on exactly what to do there. So let me ask you questions so we can sort of figure out how to deal with this issue. First of all, we know that you can put the draw limit in statute, but you can't constitutionally bind another legislature from following it. It's in that sense, it's not enforceable unless it's done. It's not enforceable, right?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, anything that's statutory can be changed by a legislature moving forward. It's not enforceable, but the idea is that by putting the formula into the statutes, we would anticipate that as the legislature followed the existing formula for many, many years, that they would follow this as well, recognizing the importance of not overdrawing on the permanent fund.
Through the chair.
Representative Gere.
I know the legislature can change the law, but it's also not enforceable in the way that, the other body, they're not following the base student allocation. We have it in the statute, but they've appropriated less money than the statute says. It's all subject to appropriation, just like this would be subject to appropriation. You don't have to change the law. The Constitution says things are subject to appropriation, so you can't really change that power in a statute. That's what I meant by it being unenforceable. Do you disagree with that?
Through the chair, Representative Garrett, no.
Okay. So here's one of the concerns. The administration's concern is valid, which is, in past years, I think we've had three $3 billion capital budgets. One of them, in my view, seemed to make sense the year that the state was facing, the nation was facing a recession in 2009. The others I personally disagreed with because of the volatility you talked about. But I was outvoted. There were good reasons to put projects there. There was a need for those projects. I get the other side. But you're trying to avoid that kind of volatility. I understand that. Here's my concern, one of my concerns. This draw limit says basically the bulk of the state's revenue, which is a combination of production taxes and earnings reserve spending. So if this were enacted, let me just make sure if I have the draw limit applies to production taxes and combined production taxes and earnings reserve draw. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the trigger is production tax and royalty. As it grows, then that's the trigger. The turndown is on the draw limit. So the trigger is oil and gas revenues. The turndown is the draw.
Through the chair.
Representative Pierre.
Thanks. Through the chair. So that actually confuses me a little bit. I thought we were somewhere in the area of $1.2 billion just in royalties right now. So if it's a $1.4 billion trigger, we're almost there. I thought it was just production taxes.
No. Through the chair, it's royalties and production tax.
Pardon?
Through the chair.
It's royalties and production tax through the trigger.
Representative Pierre.
So through the chair. Commissioner Hoffick, aren't we almost there then? I thought production taxes this year were somewhere around $1.2 billion, or royalties were somewhere around $1.2 billion. Can you just give us the numbers on that?
Through the chair, I'd have to run the numbers in my head, but I think they're about half of that.
Okay. All right. Through the chair.
Representative Kerr.
All right. So let me state one of my concerns. This draw limit, which says the largest part of the state's revenue, even if we adopted a sales tax or an income tax, the largest, biggest portion of the state's revenue is going to be this PLMV draw plus royalties plus production taxes. That's in any plan that we can think of, that's largely going to be the, what, 60-70% of our revenue. Fair to say?
To the chair, Representative Guerra, on that's currently in place, that's correct.
So, through the chair, I could see a situation where you hit this draw limit number of $1.4 billion. And then we get to the area where the state's generating $1.7 or $1.8 billion. But we don't actually get to use any additional revenue out of this between combined production taxes, royalties, and earnings reserve funds, because for every dollar one goes up, the other one goes down. And then you're at like $1.7 billion, or $1.8 billion, let's say, for 10 years. And for 10 years, every dollar that comes in from oil revenue is a dollar less than you're allowed to use from earnings reserve revenue, and you live in this sort of flat revenue situation for the bulk of your revenue for maybe 5-10 years. And you're not able to keep up with inflation or population growth or medical cost growth, and it requires internal cuts of the kind that we see right now constantly. I mean, we've seen proposed cuts to the Pioneer Home, proposed cuts to education, proposed cuts to the university, proposed cuts to the Marine Highway, proposed cuts to Children's Services, proposed cuts to juvenile justice, proposed cuts to public health nursing, proposed cuts to pre-K. Is there a way in this area where the draw limit applies to allow it to at least adjust for population and inflation growth? So for reality, the reality that the budget moves when you have more people to serve, more people who use our roads, more people who go to school, and inflation, which is the reality of life. So I mean, is there a way to adjust this draw limit to reflect population growth and inflation when you're inside that span of revenue where the draw limit applies, so you're not sitting there with, in real dollars, a decreasing budget every year?
To the chair, Representative Garrett, a couple of comments on the question. First of all, there is one other large component, and that is other revenues, and that is not caught within the draw limit. So your income, your corporate income tax, your other taxes and fees, those all are outside the limit. That's about $400 million a year. The biggest component of that is oil and gas income tax, corporate income tax on oil and gas companies. So when you see higher oil prices, higher profits, you're going to see that component growing and not be covered under the cap, the corporate income tax component. So there will be growth in the general economy with oil and gas price and production growth that won't be caught under the cap. So there is some room for growth in that other revenue category. And certainly if this legislature passes a broad-based tax, which is certainly contemplated within the language within this bill, that of course would be outside the cap as well. So you would see growth on that that would allow for growing expenditures over time. One of the concerns, of course, is there is you can't create money, right? The cap is in there as a way to balance the amount of revenues available for government services in high revenue years, so that there's money's available in lower revenue years and kind of this flattening, you know, bringing up the low ends and bringing down the high end. If the intent of the legislature is to have more room on the high end, then you have to start at a lower base in order, because you're not creating money with this system. So if you open up the draw limit and the caps in the draw limit, then you most likely have to balance that with starting with a lower draw in the first place in order to make sure that you don't over overdraw the fund. So it's a balance between the components. And as you change one set of components, you need to make sure you go back and rerun the numbers to make sure it still works against all the other components.
Through the chair.
Representative Guerra.
Yeah, I'm sorry. So, Commissioner Hoffman, this issue is really important to me as I look at this. I understand that some of the revenue might potentially go up with inflation, not population growth probably, maybe. But you're talking the bulk of the revenue that the state will receive will be subject to this flat limit. The bulk is oil revenue and POMV revenue. That's going to be somewhere to the tune of $3.5 billion. The other revenue pales in comparison. So to allow that other revenue to go up with inflation or in population growth, but make most of your revenue remain flat, overall your revenue is going to remain flat. It's like a family that has one $80,000 salary and one $20,000 salary. The $80,000 salary remains flat for 20 years, and the $20,000 salary goes up. The overall income for that household is going to fall behind inflation every single year. So my question is there a way to write this limit so that it reflects the reality of inflation and population growth? So I understand you don't want to spend every single penny you have, but what I'm trying to find out is if there's a way to write this formula to reflect that reality of inflation and population growth, because allowing one quarter of your revenue to go up and three quarters of your revenue not to go up does not achieve that.
So the Chair, Representative Garrett, first of all, the oil and gas taxes and royalty is not limited. It grows to whatever extent it grows. So your other revenues and your oil and gas tax and royalties grow. The only one that turns down is the permanent fund draw. And the permanent fund is being added to the equation now because we have insufficient revenues under the current system to pay our bills. But the idea is as oil and gas tax revenues grow and other revenues grow, then those will once again be sufficient to pay our bills. And if we reach that threshold point where we have enough in revenues from those to pay our bills, then it makes sense that we are not drawing from the permanent fund at that point in time. So this isn't that we're taking away something that's already there. What we're saying is we're willing to add this now because we need it now, but we want to turn it off in the future if we don't need it in the future. And so we aren't taking something away that's currently in the system when we put the draw limit in place. We're simply saying is that as we no longer need it in the future, we turn it off.
Finally, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Commissioner Hoffman, I'm trying to find a resolution that's fair. I know if prices go up, oil and gas revenue will grow, but within this draw limit range, as oil and gas revenue grows, the amount that you're allowed to use from the earnings reserve shrinks by that same exact amount. So the overall revenue for roughly two-thirds of our revenue, even if we had a sales tax or an income tax, does not grow within this draw limit sphere. So oil and gas revenue grows, but what's available to the state for roads and schools and maintenance does not, because the oil and gas revenue grows and the permanent fund earnings are reduced by that same amount. So am I missing something?
No, through the chair, you're absolutely right. That's the impact of the draw limit. But the reason the draw limit is in there is because recognition of that we need to use the earnings reserve now, but we may not need to use the earnings reserve in the future in order to fund government services under the other revenues that are available. So this just simply turns it off when you don't need it anymore. And it really is I guess it's probably a philosophical difference, but nobody came into this administration saying, let's figure out a way to use the permanent fund. We came in, we saw we had a huge structural deficit in our budget and said, how can we use the permanent fund to cover this structural deficit? It was never intended to add just another layer of income on top of existing revenues. It was intended to be a way to fill the gap when we needed it, but not to use it when we didn't need it.
I guess it's one final, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
Representative Guerra.
Commissioner Hoffbeck, I don't disagree with you. I think we should find a way to limit the amount of money we need out of the earnings reserve. The question was, is there a way that you could help us with that would reflect the reality of inflation and population growth that would allow us to limit the earnings reserve draw, but at least have that amount when we're living in this 5, 10, 15-year period where we're within this draw limit, where we get more than flat revenue so that we can use some portion of funds to keep up with inflation and population growth, because right now subjecting two-thirds of your revenue to no population growth or no inflation is going to leave the state in with a declining real budget every year. Is there a way to write an adjustment into the law, is what I'm asking, whether or not you agree with it?
Yeah. Through the chair, Representative Gary, what's in this CS allows for a little bit of headroom by going 80 cents on a dollar. Remember, you've got $600 million in headroom already for growth before you even hit the limit right now under current revenues. So I think the plan is in place. The committee substitute has I think tried to account for some of what you're asking for, and we'll see what ultimately passes. But the administration stands by its position that we went in this with the idea of filling a void that needed to be filled now, without the idea of hyperinflating spending in the future by having additional revenues on top of revenues that were sufficient on their own. So.
Okay, Representative Wilson and then Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I'm going to change the topic a little bit. So the conditional language with HB 111 as currently written, we heard from Mr. Alpert the other day that it was a substantial change in the way that we're doing our taxes now. My concern is that we're going to have a bigger gap because we're not going to get the corporate tax and the gain in barrels of oil we see right now because we're changing SB 21. Does the administration have any views whatsoever on the current House Bill 111 and any kind of modeling that you may have done, the department that we haven't seen yet, on the negative impacts it could have?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we're in a fiscal situation where all things are on the table, and everything that we do is going to have some impact on someone. The HB 111 is in process. It's got a long ways to go. Once it gets over to the Senate will take up a lot of those issues as well. We will see what the ultimate bill is that comes out. Recognize the fact that there's still a lot of work to do.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
But that's not true, Commissioner, because the way this bill is written, if the other body changes 111 after it goes out of here, it will then make SB 26 as if it didn't pass. So what we're talking about is the version here, not the version as it changes. And that's why I'm being very specific, you know, on my question, is that if 111 as written now, which most likely is will pass out exactly as written, goes over to the other body, in this bill it says it cannot be changed or else this is void. So does the administration have a position on the current House Bill 111 and the potential consequences of changing the tax regime the way that has been explained in that particular bill?
Through the chair, we look at the conditional language in this bill is a strong statement from this particular committee, and I assume from the House in general, their commitment to a full fiscal plan that includes both oil and gas tax reform and a broad-based tax. This bill will likely end up in a conference committee when it's all said and done, and when the conference committee will weigh all of the bills that are in front of them at the time, and I assume that this particular provision will be something that the conference committee will discuss as well.
Mr. Chairman, maybe I'm misunderstanding something, because what I heard Ms. Hansen say earlier was that, yes, it can go into a conference committee, but I would think the administration would want to have some kind of say right now as in this particular bill. I don't know whether this is a proper time to ask this question, but I'm going to try it anyway. You'll tell me whether I can say it or not. So SB 21, does the administration believe that it is producing more oil down the line?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we've answered that question many times. There's a lot of things that are in play that created the additional oil that's in place. Most of the fields that are bringing online now were fields that were in the works prior to SB 21 being passed. We can't say definitively one way or another if the investments would have continued to occur with or without SB 21, but the fields themselves were already being developed or they had been sanctioned. So SB 21 had an effect, so did oil prices, so did regulatory changes, so did a lot of other issues. And so, yes, SB 21 was part of it. How much it was, I can't tell you.
Thank you. And follow up, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. So now that we're changing it, are you confident the administration, with the new fields that haven't come on, the ones that we have heard that have found oil, how confident is the administration that they will continue with those projects or sit on them because there may be better opportunities other places and come back at some other point when we have the fiscal gap we have right now?
Well, through the chair, Representative Wilson, there's two components here that are critical. One is the amount of tax that's paid, but the second is some kind of durability and certainty in a tax system. And as long as you've got a state that's 50-50 split and a legislature that's 50-50 split on whether the current tax structure is the appropriate tax structure, there will always be a large amount of uncertainty in the underlying tax structure. What we need to do is get to a tax structure that enough people say that is good enough. We're going to leave it alone, and we're going to leave it alone for a long period of time. And I think that will probably actually have a more positive impact than the actual level of the tax, assuming that the level doesn't just become so onerous that it shuts everything down. And so I think we need to get to a landing spot where we can have a legislative session that doesn't have an oil and gas tax bill, and we need to get there relatively quickly. And we need to do that so that we can also get some of the back issues associated with credits taken care of as well, which we need the entire fiscal plan and a stable oil and gas tax policy to get there as well. Because there really is this backward look component that we need to resolve and a forward look component. And the forward look, the biggest concern that I've heard particularly from the developers and the small producers, is they just need to know what the rules are. They can make their investment decisions once they know what the rules are, but they can't make those investment decisions if they don't know what's coming next.
And one more question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
I don't think there's anybody around this table doesn't agree that the cash flow credits was something that needed to be dealt with. This bill does a lot more to it. I appreciate that the point you brought, that if it's too onerous, they'll shut things down. Do you know of any business that if they're going to increase their taxes 3 to 4 times what it is currently, would want to increase their activity in that field? Because that's what we're doing in HB 111. 3 to 4 times more we're going to be asking for. Surely, with your background, you would know that would not be a positive effect on the industry, unless I'm completely off base.
Representative Wilson, the key is 3 to 4 times what? I mean, and that really becomes the greatest statement. Just to put into perspective, because of our net tax system and the way our tax structure is set up right now and our reliance on our tax, when the oil prices collapsed, the state of Alaska lost 90% of its revenue. The next largest loss in revenue was North Dakota. They lost 30% of their revenue. Texas lost less than 1% of their revenue with the oil and gas tax price decline. So it really is a situation that the compounding effect of our reliance on oil and gas and a net tax system which exaggerates the impact of lower prices because of the impact of the you've got fixed costs and a lowering and lower revenue. We actually are at such a very low point in time that tripling sounds like a lot. But if you're tripling a very small number, it maybe isn't as big of an impact as you might think. And well, I'm sure industry will be testify, well, pretty strongly on it. But I think we really need to step back and look at, you know, just how much is the tax in comparison to other regimes. Because right now, we have taken a hit in our tax revenues that far exceeds what any other tax regime has taken.
And just a brief comment, Mr. Chairman. We can't compare ourselves to Texas. You know, the cost that we have on the North Slope, the regulations we still have on there, it's not even fair to do that. But when companies are down and having losses to then increase their tax base, that's what we're doing. We already take more of their profit than we allow them to have on the slope. I mean, the numbers are there. They come from you. In the real world, there's no way that you're going to see the same behavior as you see now when you do that kind of an intensive increase. But thank you for your comments.
Next up, we have Representative Pruitt and then Ortiz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. If House Bill 111 passes out of this House in the next couple days, should we expect the governor to say whether or not he supports or does not support it?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I think when we testify in the Senate committee, we will make some fairly definitive statements on components of HB 111.
Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Representative Pruitt.
I don't think components matter at this point in time because of the language in this bill. It's either take what the House gave or no. It's an up or down. So should we expect the governor to come out and say he supports 111 in the next couple days, because that would mean whether or not passing SB 26 matters, or whether or not it will be null and void?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, as I stated before, we see the conditional language within this bill as being a strong statement by the House majority of their intent to pass a full fiscal plan that includes oil and gas tax reform and a broad-based tax. We see this particular provision as something that will be conferenceable, and I think the conference committee will consider this particular provision in light of the other bills that it has in the conference committee at that point in time.
Follow up. Does the governor approve of the conditional language?
Again, through the chair, Representative Pruitt, we see this as a statement at this point in time.
Mr. Chair, follow up.
Representative Pruitt.
Why do we need SB 26? Why did you put it forward?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, because we need a certain amount of revenue at this point in time in order to balance the state's fiscal plan, rather than so that we don't draw down our savings to zero. And that we see the impact of drawing the savings to zero as then people moving into the using spending earnings reserve without a structure around that spending.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So you feel structure was necessary?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, that's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
We just heard earlier that the legislature can go ahead and do what they want. Yeah. But we don't need the revenue limit. Because the governor can do what we need. Do you feel still the need for 26 if the attitude of this body would be that we don't need certain aspects, need to follow the statutes for which we put in forward?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, we will always assume that the legislature will follow their own rules. That if they feel strong enough to pass this, that they will feel strong enough to follow the rules that as well. And I said in the history of the legislature, particularly as it relates to the permanent fund, as they have followed the rules lockstep, and we expect that they will do so again.
And one last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up.
Does the governor have a statement on whether or not Alaska should have a bicameral or unicameral legislature?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt. Not to my knowledge.
All right.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hoffbeck, for being here. Getting us back towards a little bit in the direction of SB 26 as opposed for HB 111, but still dovetailing a little bit on HB 111. I'm a little unclear, being green to this whole process, relatively green. Does the potential payback amount of earned tax credits Let's say, for the sake of argument, let's say that as a part of the whole package this year, we propose to pay back $125 million of those earned tax credits. Does that have any impact on the 1.2 to 1.4 revenue draw limit? Is that related at all, or does that not have any impact on that number?
To the chair, Representative Ortiz, it would not have an impact on it.
Thank you.
Any further questions of the committee? Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you know that I like you and the governor very much, but the line of questioning, which is the litmus test, has to be whether the governor supports it. I don't think any member of this committee has ever supported, as you know, right? Certainly my intention is to work with the governor, but whether the governor supports this language doesn't affect me, and whether the governor supported the proposed education cuts by some others didn't affect them. It's just the way the process works. The big remaining question I have is, this bill by itself does not solve the budget gap. So this bill sort of begs either folks can, I guess they can find more education cuts or university cuts to try and meet the revenue by this bill and by itself. But what's your view of this bill by itself as being a fiscal plan that protects the state? Is this fine, or do we need more balance and revenue from other sources?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. As we testified in the past on 115 and on 26, that as a standalone, they don't get us to the finish line. And if there is not a broader fiscal plan that goes along with the use of the permanent fund, that eventually you will deplete your savings and start making unscheduled draws against the earnings reserve, and that's where you start to see the failure rate of the earnings reserve climb dramatically. So this is the largest piece of the solution, but without either substantial additional expenditure reductions or a broad-based tax capable of generating somewhere in the neighborhood of $650 to $700 million, or a combination of taxes that do so, eventually you will start to deplete your earnings reserve in the future. So this doesn't stand by itself as an entire package.
Just wanted to restrain.
Follow up.
Thank you. My concern is if we don't solve the budget gap, it's going to have a negative impact on the economy. Number one, if it's continued cuts and inability to have a capital budget, it damages the economy because there's less money in the economy, and not to mention the impacts on schools and things like that. But the other is the business community is going to wonder where the rest of the revenue is going to come from, which will cause instability. So do you agree with my assessment that a partial plan is dangerous to the economy?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, a partial plan does not take the uncertainty out of the equation. You can solve 80% of the problem, and you'll leave 100% of the uncertainty still in the economy. And so we have to get a full plan. Does it have to be all implemented this year? No. But do people need to know what the plan is? I mean, you have delayed effective dates on a broad-based tax, for instance. As long as people know when it's coming and how much it's going to be, they can plan for it. What they can't plan for is not knowing what comes next. And you've had several large companies within the state of Alaska say that they are holding back investment until they know. And so I think you're correct. We need a full fiscal plan to take the uncertainty out of the economy so that the economy can start to grow.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson?
Maybe I misunderstand this bill, because this bill is already wanting $665 million at least from Alaskans in some form of a broad-based tax. They're wanting to, I think, kill the oil industry, but that's just my personal opinion. And then it also is taking a draw off the permanent fund earnings, 33% going toward dividends and the other part going toward government. So as this bill is written, and maybe this is not a question to the commissioner but to the chairman, are we also looking at other taxes to fill the gap that the representative was talking about that is not in this bill? I think think that's probably to the chairman, because what we just heard from the representative is that we need more than what's in this bill. It's already asking for $665 million more. It's asking for 111 to be exactly whatever passes out of the House. And is asking for a permanent fund earnings draw, of which 33% go to the people. So what else may the representative be talking about that we're going to add besides what's currently in the bill? I just must be missing something.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I think that there's some confusion of when we're talking about in the bill. I think that there's title number problems when we're talking about SB 26. We have to be talking now about the House Committee substitute, and the House Committee substitute with its conditional language does institute a full fiscal plan. It has the POMV draw, it has a broad-based tax, and it has reform of oil and gas taxes and credits. And so with the implementation, if it would go through the way it was with the other two pieces being passed, then that would be a full fiscal plan. One needs to remember that there's also one other thing that was incorporated in the budget, both the House and the Senate version, which was a motor fuels tax. And so that's incorporated in the budget, so one should assume that has been voted on by both the House and the Senate with those numbers incorporated. So that is the only other component that I believe we would need for a full fiscal plan and have a balanced budget going forward in the future when things are fully implemented. And there are delayed effective dates. The delayed effective date on the broad-based tax that we have in this plan is exactly the same as we had in 115, which was January 1, 2019. And so there are time intervals here, but all those pieces passed together will get us a balanced budget in about 2021. I hope that's the answer to your your question, but all three pieces would need to pass in some form, and we know that we will be looking at conference committee on items, as we always do when there are complex items between the House and the Senate. But this shows our commitment to a full fiscal plan and not passing just a portion of it and walking away.
And Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilson.
I thought we were talking about the committee substitute. Got a little confused with some of the questioning. I wasn't sure we were talking about the budget, the committee substitute, HB 115, 111. So it's nice to know that besides these two taxes, we may not be looking at other ways of taxing Alaskans. Thank you.
Okay. Any further, Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, I wanted to follow up with the chair. I guess one of the things that one of the questions since this is, I think that it's fair to say that there was quite a bit of involvement from co-chair in this. What role should the public's ideas on this, the way that we handle this fiscal plan, be incorporated into our decision making?
Representative Seaton.
I think that was question was directed to me, and of course, when we had these elements combined together, we had public testimony on it. We heard public testimony there. There was changes, quite a bit of changes, as you recognize, based on the public testimony in the income tax section of that bill, and we had some testimony on the draw limits, et cetera, and that's partly why the draw limits are where they are in here. So we are listening to public testimony, and we will listen to that again from 4 to 7 tonight on this part of the bill. And I think we'll be seeing the other portions very soon. We had public testimony on the oil and gas tax sections, and as you noticed, we changed a number of items in that. So public testimony is very critical for looking at elements.
So, Mr. Chair.
Representative Pruitt.
So in the survey, co-chair Seaton, that you put out, newsletter survey, 67% of the respondents said that we should not increase oil and gas production taxes for companies in Alaska. In addition to that, follow up with Mr. Rosario the other day indicates that what is taking place in the 111 would be because of the removal of the per barrel credits. Said depending on the market price this used, this could be a substantial increase. So I guess I'm going to follow up again with basically what you just said. If we were to listen to your own survey, there would be an outstanding discussion of no on 111, which 111 is then included in here as a key component of this particular bill of it doesn't go forward unless 111 were to go forward. So I guess I'm confused here. If you're hearing in your own newsletter that there's concern about pieces of this, then why would that not be taken into account?
Representative Seaton.
Well, Mr. Chairman, there's multiple pieces of information we get, and there's we listen to people talk, and we take those things into consideration. We have to make decisions based upon the reality as we see it. We search out, but this is not a public vote, and we don't listen to 40 people and say, "Oh, we have to do exactly what they did," because, you know, 40 people said something. This is a iterative process by which we look at solving the problems of the state of Alaska, and they're not solved by simple surveys, whether it's the Senate survey of 7,000 people instead of a few that said they wanted a broad-based tax, and I think 70% of those total people said they either wanted a sales tax or an income tax, and the majority were in favor of both of those. So, you know, we have a interesting amount of public testimony we go by, and we have to look at all of those things, but they're just public testimony, and they give us ideas. Thank you.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, first, I want to say I have a different opinion on what Mr. Ruggiero said, because he clearly wouldn't say what people asking him questions wanted him to say. I think that was true for everybody around the table. I have his quotes also extracted, and he said it was pretty moderate. We heard from the public, and they were quite diverse, but I think that you couldn't say it was overwhelmingly one side or the other. The other body has a survey. Everywhere I've gone, I've heard, fix it, there's a problem. And as often as not, is everybody has to be at the table. Over the past few years, there's been a pretty loud voice in this body that said, don't you know we have a fiscal problem? Repeatedly, you know, when we talked about, you know, whether the formula funding for education or marine highways or public broadcasting. And I find it ironic that at times now that it doesn't seem to be so critical that we can just keep going on. And I think we've heard over the years we can keep going on. We are getting very near to the cliff. The administration came in with the prices plummeted, face a bizarre fiscal crisis by unforeseen drop in oil. Over the past few years, there's been enough economists that have come in and say, here's your road to the cliff, fix it before you get there. CEOs have come into the office and said, just like the commissioner stated, you need to fix it. You don't have to get there. You need to fix it. There's a lot of investment that's on hold. There are some comprehensive plans on the table that are that actually do it in a comprehensive way and hit the economy balanced across the boards. Don't put the stress on any one segment of the economy. I think each one of them can deal with that, can live with that as long as it's not them. You know, last year we had the three taxes, and they all three of those industries said, just not me. I think that's where we're at now. Just everybody's at the table. Everybody has an interest. I think the this component by itself doesn't answer anything. The other body wants to leave a $500 million hole forever.
that's crisis management. We have the opportunity to stabilize the state's economy, where all the economists are looking at it getting ready to crash if we don't act. We have all the tools. Every year, the previous year, we had a larger amount of money to be able to invest and stabilize it, and we didn't do anything. Now we're at the point. We have all the tools. We've heard all of these things over the years in very comprehensive ways, and we're at the point now we have the ability to stabilize the state's economy, make sure we're on the long-term footage. We can take out some of the spikes in the volatility of the permanent fund. We can keep the people getting a dividend, which is very important. We can balance this over the years, or we cannot. You know, we can just do this in segments and be in crisis every year. The oil industry knows that we have an unstable oil taxation policy. The best thing that can happen to them is that we stabilize the economy, that we can pay back credits that we owe. That's one of the things that they want to see happen. You know, there's a difference between what the oil lobbyists and lawyers and accountants say at this table and what they say around the world. Those guys are paid to say something that to put pressure on us to not touch them. Around the world, there's slides and presentations that they have done that say other things. At the end of the day, Alaska has the rocks. That's what's the most important thing. But here we are, we're one part of this dividend, of managing our dividend. We've accomplished the goal of turning oil into cash, and we're able to do that in the long term. And whether it's kids in college or K-12 or industry being able to invest, or a mom-and-pop store knowing that people in their neighborhood are going to have cash to spend, that's what's important. And I think we're there. We have the opportunity to do that, and I think we should move forward and get it done.
Other questions of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Representative Guerra. Thank you, sir. We're not actually in like final debate, right? Though I think we all think we are. We haven't done amendments, right?
We have not done amendments, but they will be due soon.
Okay. I do want to say if I could, Mr. Chair.
Representative Guerra.
Since the discussion's gone a little further than we all probably should have moved it. But, look, I'm willing to take the heat. And I think a number of the legislators are, because of the reality that we know that maybe we haven't gotten to the public, which is that after $3.4 billion of budget cuts, the University of Alaska says every $100 million more will cause the loss of 1,000 to 1,500 private and public sector jobs. And we're already in recession. And if this legislature ends the session by just rearranging the chairs in the Titanic, that's not leadership. You know, you can try and do whatever you want. I could, as a legislator, try and do whatever I want to get the most votes possible. But to sink the economy to do that, I'm not going to do. And if all we leave is a budget that requires more and more job losses, every $100 million more in cuts is a loss of another 1,000 to 1,500 private sector and public sector jobs. If you're going to do that, you're going to destroy the economy. So I'm not wedded to exactly how we solve this problem, but this combination that we've talked about seems rational. With that, I think we probably will go through a lot of this in third or in another day. Thanks.
Any questions for general comments or comments for questions for Commissioner Hoffbeck? Representative Pruitt?
Not from Commissioner Hoffbeck. He probably wants out of there anyway. So, Mr. Chair, if any of myself or my Republican colleagues put up any amendments, would you guys support any of them? I haven't had a single amendment this whole year on any single bill that's been accepted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Seaton.
That's not true at all. Representative Pruitt, you had an amendment.
We yanked it out.
We did when we found out that it was violating the single subject rule, and you probably had a memo from the alleged legal that followed that amendment that you did not share with this committee, and so then we removed it. Yes. So are there amendments that we've taken? We've taken amendments from minority members. Maybe if there are amendments that aren't meant to hijack the legislation or to give it legal problems and that information isn't shared, probably amendments would be considered.
Senator Pruitt.
Mr. Chair, I'm just trying to figure out what we'd wait anymore for the amendment process. Because if there really isn't going to be any credence given to any suggestions, you can pretty much figure what amendment I'd put in here right now. Just strip out Section 19. And I'm pretty confident that I'd get turned down on that. So why are we going to extend this out anymore? Let's just move this thing out. Let's get it out of here. Or just stop it here. Because unless the chairs have some more amendments to the thing that they put forward, and I'm sure you've talked to other members of your caucus, and there's not a surprise on this, I don't know why we'd delay this any longer. We're moving up against the 90 days. People were not happy with this that we extended last year. All the time, I'd knock on the doors. Why can't you get your job done in time? This is just going to extend this out even longer. And recognizing that amendments that I'd offer would not be accepted, I don't understand why we delay this any longer. Let's just move because people need us to. They want us to move on this stuff.
Thank you, Representative Pruitt. Do we have any further questions or comments? Seeing none, we'll continue to follow our process. We do want to ensure that the public has an opportunity to weigh in, and that if members do have amendments, that they can submit them. And so, with that, amendments will be due to my aide on. Tomorrow, which is Tuesday, April 11th, 2017, at 11 a.m. Again, that's to Jane Pearson. And with that, see no further business before us at this time. Our next scheduled meeting is for 4 p.m. this afternoon, Monday, April 10th. And there we will be taking public testimony on SB 26. And with that, we will be adjourned at 9:25, or we will be recessed at 9:25 a.m. Representative Wilson.
Make sure it's a committee substitute for House Bill 26 so people know that there's a change, or committee substitute for SB 26.
And that's correct, Representative Wilson. It'll be the House CS for SB 26, the finance version, which is version U, uniform. Thank you for the clarification. And with that, we'll be recessed at 9:25 a.m. and we'll be back here at 4 p.m. today. Thank you.